Okay, it's Cameron and Bob. We're back. Episode number 32. And Cameron has something to say right away. He's looking at a quote on page 17 from Take Today, page 152. I'll let Cameron say the quote or break it apart, however he wants to attack it. Go ahead.
All right. Well, we were talking about the peace that passeth all technology. And the idea there was that the overkill was a form of peace, that we've gotten ourselves into such a huge danger, you say, that it's created the public benefit of relative peace. But what this quotation does in one of its senses is say that that relative peace is very, very dangerous and could easily precipitate the opposite of any kind of peace. So he says that in the quotation that we're looking at from Take Today, page 152, the second sentence starts, such a service environment can liquidate or terminate its beneficiaries as naturally as it sustains them. And what he's saying there is that we may have some kind of relative peace because war has become so dangerous, so threatening to life on Earth that people can't undertake it. But McLuhan points out that, well, it can liquidate or terminate its beneficiaries as naturally as it sustains them. And what's noteworthy in his language here is a doubling or multi-level effect that McLuhan talked about from the very beginning of his work. He was always trying to point out that words and meanings cannot be pinned down. And so that also goes for the relative peace of an atomic balance between the powers. That can very easily turn into the annihilation of its beneficiaries or of its supposed beneficiaries. And the really big question posed by the modern world is who benefits from us getting ourselves into this ridiculous situation? Why are we spending $1 trillion or $2 trillion a year in what's called defense instead of spending that money to the benefit of people? And I don't think anybody knows the answer to that question. The new overkill is, first of all, a question. And when he says that that's an extension of our nervous system, too, is a question. As to say, what human being is first of all, a question, a answer to which human beings don't know.
Well, the new overkill is simply an extension of our nervous system. Does that mean that our nervous systems are in a state of overkill inside us?
In a certain way, yes. Hmm. Our nervous system has always been the potential to develop something like an atomic standoff.
So what we've done, an atomic standoff? Or
yeah, that's where we are, or a nuclear standoff. We're in a situation of, using your phrase, of relative peace, right? And what does relative peace mean? It means that our weapons have become so ridiculously dangerous that we need peace just to survive. The problem is the chance of an accident or the need to respond to some perceived threat can lead to nuclear war at any second. So that possibility as an extension of our nervous system has always been the case, and now it's been realized. So this total ecological service environment that McLuhan talks about, he immediately goes on to talk about in terms of liquidation and termination.
Well, I'm not sure what you want to develop about that. You say, we don't know the answer. Not going to get the answer. So do you just ignore that?
No. What's needed, according to McLuhan, is that we have to revisit what questionability means and what an answer is. For McLuhan, the whole problem that has been constellated in the modern world is that we take questionability and we take what it would be to have an answer in Gutenbergian terms. And when we do that, then raising a question is something negative. And having something negative means that you have no answer. And for McLuhan, that is what our problem is. We have to see that questionability is positive, or we have to see that questionability in some senses is negative, but in the most important senses, it's positive. And that questionability, as we can see in the physical sciences, is what generates answers. But by dragging Gutenbergian perspective into the modern world, in fact, by defining the modern world in terms of Gutenbergian perspective, then we come up with questionability as negative and as generating no answer, namely nihilism. And that's exactly the cul-de-sac in which we began all of our conversations 32 episodes ago.
Yes, 31 episodes. I guess we are beginning the 32nd. So
correct.
Have we done 32? Not yet, right?
Right.
Yeah, we are just starting the 32nd.
That's
we're
revisiting your attachment to linearity and my attachment to simultaneity.
Right. Now, you raised this question. I don't know. Do you need any statement to be made about it? You've said that's a very important question for McLuhan.
I see what I'm doing is commenting on your book by pointing out its multiple levels. And for McLuhan, at least, that's what reading is.
Yeah.
And so in terms of the overall theme of the book, you could say that the Trump phenomenon requires close reading. And when we read Trump closely, then you see many different levels, and that complicates what the man was, what the man is, and according to you, that then leads on. This is according to page number 8. That then leads on to the Android meme phase 1, Android meme phase 2, anthropomorphic physical, and the tech body.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the global village and the global theater are what might be called the dance of multi-levels.
Right. So I was thinking, I'm thinking of why I put that quote in, and I'm saying in my commentary, there's a balance. There's a total ecological balance happening in the 50s and 60s on the shores of California. And then there's oil problem, I think I say later. But this, there is this balance happening between the services and the disservices. And that's part of McLuhan's vision. And he says we're getting agitated by the wrong things.
Correct. Correct. And let's remember that McLuhan, as a Catholic, believes that balance is the last word. But he's speaking to people that 99% either are not Catholic or think they're Catholics but don't know anything about Catholicism, right?
Yeah.
So he's speaking to an environment that's 99% unbalanced. And so his language needs to be rather complex and in some senses seemingly misdirected. But that's because of this extremely complicated situation that he faces and which he sees people like Joyce also facing, where you need to speak to people about the extreme danger that they have placed themselves in, including the total annihilation of human life on Earth. You say that from a perspective that still believes in balance. And how to talk about those things is together is very, very difficult.
I'm scanning down to see what I talk about next. People think we're a unified global culture today with the Internet or social media 2.0, just as the world was for the chemical body integrated in the 20s by the blacks.
What page are you on here? Oh, you're
18.
On page 18.
Yeah,
okay.
So then I go into jazz, the blacks united the world.
Right, but notice, Bob, what's going on here is that you realize, either consciously or unconsciously, that the whole question of balance was being posed.
Yeah.
And all of these things that you go through on page 18 concern the question of balance. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. But we don't seem to know how to articulate balance.
Correct. That's exactly the problem. Exacto.
Yeah, the balance, not what we thought it was, but the way to get balance.
Correct. Absolutely. That is the whole question posed by all of the great thinkers from all time, that it has in the 21st century, it has come to an extreme where the answer to that question, or the, the interrogation of that question may be what the future of the human race depends on.
Well, where are we going to get the question raised? Well, we're doing it.
Well, we're trying to do it.
Yeah.
But Nietzsche tried to do it, and Lewis tried to do it, and Joyce tried to do it, and Eliot tried to do it, and McLuhan tried to do it. So, and Plato tried to do it. So we're talking at least 2,500 years after these sorts of questions have been raised, and all there has been is failure, and where our conversation takes place in that context. We're trying to raise certain questions, especially about balance, but how that can be done is the great question. And it's especially a great question when ultimately there can be no balance of one thing. There has to be a balance, like a teeter-totter, is always two things.
Yeah.
And so the balance itself can only be balanced by unbalance. And the trying to get a handle or trying to get some kind of grasp on that difficult knot between balance and unbalance, that's sort of what human being turns on.
Right. Now, do you think that the Aboriginal cultures are balanced, that they have a wisdom for us?
Well, let's differentiate between a series of questions that are involved there. First, I've got a frog in my throat here. Are or were Aboriginal cultures all the same? And the answer to that is clearly no. Then we could ask, well, take any one Aboriginal culture. Was it the same? And the answer there is also no. The kids, when they were teenagers, did they understand what some shaman understood in that same culture? And the answer is no. No. So things have always been complicated. That's one question and one answer to it. Another question is, what did these people do all the time when they weren't sleeping or they weren't hunting or they weren't cooking or they weren't doing things with stone or doing things with wood? What were they doing? And the answer for some of the people was that they were thinking. And so the chances are pretty good that at least in some cultures, in the 100,000 years or so that human beings have been around, at least in some cultures, there was probably more thinking and conceivably better thinking going on than what we can do. Right? They didn't have all of the distractions. Some people probably spent most of their lives, most of their life, simply thinking, probably looking at the stars and wondering what the hell the stars were telling them.
Mm.
So this is the second question. Was there at least in some cultures some great thinking going on? I think the answer is probably yes. It's probably something that we in our time aren't equal to.
Mm.
Right. Third question. Given that great variety over that great span of time, I mean, we've been literate for 2,500 years. Or if we, you know, don't believe Havelock and McLuhan, and we think that the Mesopotamians and the Egyptians were literate in some sense, then 3,500 years. Mm. We can tack on another 1,000 years to that. But humans have been around for at least 100,000, and arguably with some of the new finds in Morocco and in Western Africa over there, maybe 300,000 years. So our period has been very, very small in comparison to the total history of the species. So then the third question would be, well, what are our resources for attempting to emulate or to interrogate or to find out what these people, the best ones, what they achieved in their best thinking? And I think for that, all we can do is try to encourage some people who have been blessed by having good minds to focus as much of their time as possible on these deep questions. So I would say those are three ways of thinking about the question you asked me that generally aren't asked.
Yeah.
And probably there are other ones too.
Yes.
But the question that you asked about the Aboriginal peoples is much more complicated than people generally believe.
So do you feel that people have lost control right now? Do you think that we're at the worst, most dangerous time we've ever done since you've been alive?
Yes, I think that's probably the case.
What are you seeing going on out there to make you say that? And you know, you can't say, well, we've always been nuts, you know. Let's pretend there's something different here. What do you
right.
see?
So,
do you watch the news? You don't do the news, right?
Well, it all depends on what you mean by news. I certainly don't look at what's called Main Street media, never.
Right. Do you go to Drudge? Drudge?
No, I don't know what that means.
How do you know what's going on? I have a sense of what's going on.
By doing digital research, you could say. Right?
Statistics?
Doing digital research, you would think, in the McLuhan industry would be something obvious. Right? But
yeah.
As far as I can see, people don't know how to do it. So I research the quote-unquote news in the same way as I read your book. And that is that I see something online, the Azerbaijanians want to build a new pipeline into Europe to compete with Russia, let's say.
Yeah.
So then I have to try and figure out, how the countries around the Caspian Sea are situated and how the sea is divided up between the different powers and what the possibilities are for a pipeline project, where, through what countries it would go and all this sort of stuff. That's what I do with everything. I try to see through some language that I know I don't know anything about. I try to look into what's below it.
So you don't consume news or wait for someone to send it to you. You do. You're a journalist in that sense. You go
maybe
research.
Yeah. Correct. So a sense of journalism that has pretty much disappeared from the world, as far as I can see. But there are people that, I got to say that sometimes I listen to Amazing Folly.
Yes.
From your website, and I like the way that she does research.
Yeah.
And she when she wants to look into a topic. Basically, she does searching online, and she keeps on searching and searching and searching into the depths of what she's finding.
Yeah.
And I think that's excellent. I think that's actually the way thinking should work. Thinking should always be, it doesn't matter if you're talking about the news or if you're talking about something that just sort of flashed through your head or something, you should always try to find out what lies below it.
Yes, and so if you looked at the latest one she's posted, did you listen to the today, say? I think Ed put it up today, this past day. Did you listen to her?
You know, I really don't know.
Okay.
Sorry. I can't remember the last time I looked at her.
I recommend this one. She's come to a peak. Uh-huh. It's titled, I'm Over Coronavirus. She says she...
Oh, I did. I did hear that. Yeah.
Did you go all the way through? I found it very entertaining. She's had it. It's interesting. We're looking at someone. She's been doing the coronavirus, he said, 19 months. Many videos. And she, now this is what I was thinking of when I said, is it worse now? She says, we are in a state of anarchy at the top. Did you hear her say that?
Yes.
Anarchy at the top.
That's true.
Yes.
Yes.
And she recognizes, she says, I'm not compromising. I'm not going to get my apps. I don't care if you do. And I don't care, you know, you're going to get your apps so you can go to a football game or get vaccinated. I'm not doing it. And I may end up being a recluse. We're seeing someone come to a tetrad, an epiphany. They realize that's it. And she says, I might have other things to look into. I don't know. She seems to be implying she has other interests. But what's going on right now, she's not going to let us do any of it anymore. Because she has proven to herself 100 times that everybody's lying. And it's just impossible to come up with something to tell other people what's happening. Just can't be done.
Correct. But a couple comments. Number one, she's directing the comments that you just gave to the COVID situation.
Right.
So she says in that video that she has plenty of other topics to go on to, and she's going to do that. So that's number one. Number two, when she says there's anarchy at the top, she doesn't really interrogate that in the way that I would recommend.
Yes.
Namely, what does anarchy mean in that situation? And that's where I bring in Nietzsche. And I try to show in my blog and in the comments that I've made in our conversation, I try to show that Nietzsche sees anarchy as self-dissolving. That once you interrogate anarchy, it dissipates into nihilism, because the rules that have disappeared are the foundation of the world. So you can't take away the rules that structure the world without losing the world.
Mm.
So then once you understand that the world has been lost as a totality, right, that you've entered the dark night of the soul, but there is no you and there is no soul and there is no night, once you realize those sorts of things, then you have some idea of the cul-de-sac, and that's where we began our conversation.
Well, I find it interesting to listen to her and say, now, what would I say to her? I think right now it'd be difficult to bring in what I think I know that she doesn't know, and don't know how I'd communicate it to her, but she'd be someone I'd like to communicate, give her some insights. I don't know if they would be insights. Because she has done her own research so intensely, she's kind of, evolved into quite a strong perception of things.
That's right. I don't know why you would. Why would you want to talk to somebody if you only wanted to give them information? Why wouldn't you want to talk to somebody to dialogue?
Well, that's what I mean.
To give and receive.
I'm not sure what area to talk to her about, how to talk to her.
Oh, it wouldn't matter. Any topic would do, because she has a very lively mind, and so do you. And it would be a very interesting conversation, probably much more interesting than you and me.
That's right. Yeah, it would be. No, it's, she's intense. We're probably more intense than you are in our conversational situation. You know, I'm, do you ever listen to me and Jack? Have you seen those dialogues?
No, never heard of Jack.
Okay, so he's this black entrepreneur, black businessman, a young guy. And so
I'm sorry, okay, yeah, so I know who it is. It's a guy that you talk to every couple of weeks.
Yes.
The basketball player, that
guy. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, sorry. No, I don't listen to those, no.
Okay, well, the last one everybody thinks is fantastic, and I ran through a history of different things. But what's interesting is I'm saying, to me, absolutely boring McLuhan stuff. But he wants me to talk about it because he's reading the book. So I go into it, and his listeners get really excited. Like, they, wow, this is real information. And, you know, I'm so used to it, it's not very valuable to me at this point. I prefer my five bodies. But I find it interesting to put myself in that situation where I don't know what to tell them, what level to go into. And so I just wing it or improvise. And then I say stuff, and they're all blown away. I'm trying to figure out what it is they think they're getting from me. You know, the McLuhan language, I guess, is a bizarre language, but it does kind of communicate. It's simple. And if people hear it, they like it. They think they're learning something. So I'm sort of wondering what they're learning.
I think you just put your finger on it. You said they think they're learning.
Yeah.
Right now, in our contemporary situation, for many, many people, there has never been education in the etymological sense.
Yeah.
Right? This leading out of where you are into something different. Right? So these are, many times, these are very intelligent people, but they do not understand anything about intelligence. Right? So it's when they are informed about themselves in a way that leads them out of trivialities into something a little bit deeper, then that's very pleasurable for them. That's what, you know, that's what human beings are all about. That's when a baby is born, it is gradually educated into complexities that it had no idea about. And if human beings didn't find that inherently pleasurable, then there wouldn't be a species. It's built into people, as McLuhan would say, to outer themselves, to find themselves in their extensions. And probably the people that react favorably to what you're saying see in your explanations an education unlike what they've experienced before.
Yeah, it's hearing a new language presented non-pompously, just sort of straightforward. And so it's the appeal of new language. It's kind of like poetry. I'm not doing iambic pentameter, but it's, you know, poetry is jungling up the words, changing them, putting them in different patterns from your normal dull conversations. So I'm activating their poetic sense, their aesthetic sense, and they like it. And people, if they're given a chance, anybody would respond to that if they're reasonably balanced or reasonably healthy mentally. They like it. So I then wonder where to go next. Leave the McLuhan poetry, go to another kind of poetry. But I don't get too worked up about it. I just, what's interesting is that somebody will say something. I don't have to carry the whole thing. The other people, they're waiting to say something. And so you get these people calling in, and they'll say, man, you're talking truth. The blacks have some phrase, whatever it is, something about what it is. You're talking about what it is. And then they want to talk. And if I just shut up, they get to actually say back to me what I said to them. Not exactly the same frameworks, but they tell me what they know. So I've given them permission to talk about what they think they know after I presented what I thought I knew. And that's an interesting interplay. And that probably makes them feel better. And then that's a bit of peace that happens. In them. So,
are you using the word peace, P-E-A-C-E?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
There's some kind of release. So, as I'm talking, explaining, I'm watching their reactions. In a way, I'm studying the effects. And find it very interesting to do it when it seems to be going well. Now, there's always someone who calls in and is right out of, doesn't have a clue even to get any peace. And they just talk about their agitation maybe. And I don't know if they get any relief. But that's completely different to when I meet on Wednesday and talk to intelligent people, including Clinton. We talk differently.
Listen, it's not that the difference in conversation is not between intelligent people or non-intelligent people. The people that think they're intelligent in this world are usually dumber than hell. And they usually have stuff that they could learn from people. They always are in a situation where they could learn from people that they consider as unintelligent. So please don't think that when you're talking to Clinton and his buddies that you're talking to intelligent people, and when you're talking to Jack, you're talking to unintelligent people. That is not the case, believe
well,
me.
Well, the intelligence is a whole different language.
But that's not has nothing to do with intelligence. It's just a different language.
Well, the intelligence is
different
how to modulate,
level of bullshit.
How to call the bullshit, or to say something that I don't have to be cautious about saying something, or I can be more complex with them. More complex, because Jack won't let me get too complex.
That's good.
Simple.
Yeah, the whole, I mean, look at the whole, the McLuhan industry, just to take an example, thinks that it's very complicated, thinks that it's juggling vast ideas that are tremendously important for the history of the world or something. And that's all bullshit. Okay? So, this complication is not necessarily sophisticated or intelligent or anything else. It can easily be just a game that people play, right? So I would simply say that the people asking for clarity, asking for something to be said straight out, is an excellent thing in the modern world. Education, let's say at the university level, in social sciences and in the humanities, has become largely an exercise in nonsense. Right? People are taught to think that they're smarter than whoever they're reading. Right? It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But that's what education has become. So if Jack and his listeners are saying to you, well, you know, what's a medium? What do you mean by electric? that's excellent.
Yeah.
That sort of cuts through all the bullshit. That's, you might say that is the higher education than what the universities have become.
Okay, so
but
what?
I don't know. I'm talking through my ass.
Yeah, you're talking through your ass.
I haven't
here.
Listened.
Let me say something. How would you apply some McLuhan language to explaining why universities have become stupid the way you're saying?
That's a very complex question.
Oh, there you go. Complex.
Yeah, that's right.
Jack would buy that complex.
I don't think there's something wrong with complication, Bob. I say that complication, depending upon how it's exercised, depending on how it's interrogated, can be just a game and can be bullshit. But complication is the name of what goes on with human beings. Human beings, as soon as they use language, are introducing very complex things into the environment. There's not only the exterior environment, the exterior landscape, there's also the interior landscape. And so the complications not only go outwards, they also go inwards. And that's sort of what the history of psychoanalysis is since Freud and Jung and Adler.
What is making people, and I'm trying to explain why people are noticing anarchy at the top. Something's going on at the top, and the top is missing something. And I say it's the evolution of technology into the tech body. And no one would believe it's gotten that far. Mm-hmm. What do you say is the reason there's anarchy at the top?
Well, let me just say that when you talk about this evolution of anarchy into the tech body, that's something that I don't understand, and it's something that your book is addressing. We went to the end to understand something about the tech body, and now we're going through McLuhan and then ultimately Trump to try to understand something of that evolution you're talking about. Mm. So that said, then I'll go to your question, and that was, what do I think is going on with anarchy at the top? And personally, I don't think that there is such a thing as the top that needs to be straightened out in some way. I think what has happened is that we've through the developments of modern technology and modern thinking, we have got ourselves into a cul-de-sac where everything falls apart. Mm. And the people of goodwill, at least, are looking for what Wittgenstein calls a way of leading the fly out of the fly bottle. However, if things have fallen apart, we really can't say whether that has been intentional or whether it has been unintentional. And so the anarchy at the top precipitates the question of whether or not this anarchy is something that has simply befallen us like a fate, or whether it's a trap. And presumably, these are the sorts of questions that lead into the tech body, but we have to see when we get through the book.
Okay, so let's look at this article and where we're at. And
Bob, you don't have anything to say about the question of whether anarchy is unintentional or intentional?
I'm coming at it this way.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to get back into the article and see if that answers the question or clarifies. And
okay.
So I'm looking at what I said and did, and it's a I'm explaining McLuhan to people. I think it's valuable to understand the stages that McLuhan appeared to go through. So that's what I'm doing here. But I'm trying to find, is there something here that Yeah, I'm going through the definition of medium, and I was reading some art history, and they were talking about Nam June Paik, you know, the guy who did the video art with McLuhan, and they said he was pointing out, Nam June was pointing out that the TV medium required a different kind of investigation than McLuhan was doing. Now, Nam June Paik got his ideas about the TV medium from McLuhan, but he thought that McLuhan wasn't investigating it properly. He was just observing and writing a book or two about it, not engaging it. And what did engagement mean? Well, Nam June Paik came up with putting little wires into the TV set and distorting the image. You know what I mean? Have you seen Nam June Paik's work?
No.
Yeah,
I don't even know who the guy is. How do you spell his last name?
P-A-I-K. He's a Korean artist, part of Fluxus in the John Cage world in the 60s. And he got turned on. He got one of the first video cameras off the boat. And inspired by McLuhan, he started making Zen video art, I guess he called it. But he would distort the image of McLuhan. You can go on YouTube, put in Nam, N-A-M.
Yeah, I've already got it up. I see it, and I did know who he was.
I just
wasn't understanding what you were saying. But the whole problem with this is that it takes something like a TV or something like magnetism or something like electricity, literally. And whereas for McLuhan, if you do that, you've automatically fallen into the Gutenbergian world. And this indeed is the great problem of the modern world, how it can extricate itself from Gutenberg. So we've got all these great inventions like atomic bombs or like applications that can listen to everything that goes on, irregardless of whether your computer or your smartphone is on or off. Everything is recorded. Everything goes into a huge data bank somewhere and gets massaged. So we've got these huge, how can we say, inventions, but we think about them, at least us peons, think about them in terms of Gutenberg.
Now this is what
problem.
Nam June Paik was doing. Now he thought McLuhan was talking about the qualities and traits of the video image and how they were so different from a book. And that is the first understanding of medium in the 50s, early 60s when people read McLuhan. Because I'm going to get to the point where the medium is not, in my stages here, is not the new figure. It's the society that's already been created. That's the medium. And you'll start to see that it gets agitated. And that means there's some new environment sneaking in there that's agitating, but you can only see the rearview mirror agitation. That level...
I agree with all that.
So I'm pointing this out, that I'm going through the meaning of the word medium as McLuhan changed it or expanded it. And Nam June Paik, somebody's taking his version of medium, a very early definition of McLuhan, and making a big deal out of it, getting art grants, and becoming a famous video artist. And I see it as very trivial, what he was doing. And makes me think about the New York art world, how silly it was, John Cage and those guys. And yet they knew to hang around McLuhan and claim to understand him and make their art to even correct McLuhan. So I had that in mind. Go ahead.
And I agree with all of that. The only footnote I would put in is that although these people were ultimately misdirected, what they were doing is they were looking at complications and wondering about what these complications meant, right? So by distorting the image on the TV or something like that, what does it mean that we can do this? And what does it mean that the image can do this, et cetera? And those are good questions, right? So the way that the human species works is that there are a huge number of people, there's a much bigger number of people that can ask questions and that can complicate things as compared to the small number of people that can come up with answers. And so most of these artists, a disappearingly small number of those artists actually got into answers. The rest of them were just complicating things in a way that can be appreciated, but it's not answers.
Right. So I'm glad that I thought of the Paik thing, because he's a perfect example of someone doing the first level of my definition of the medium, the global village level. And then I know I can see what he, very limited, and I don't think he improved his understanding of McLuhan. He didn't keep studying McLuhan. He just went with what he read in understanding media, which was ancient when it came out in McLuhan's thinking. And they think that's McLuhan. And
right. And let's just say that we have to also look at why McLuhan was talking like that, right? What happened in the 1950s that kicked McLuhan into this talk about media?
Yeah.
And the answer is that people were becoming conscious of the difference between, say, books and television when it came to education, especially. So people were wondering, can we use these devices to help education? And McLuhan realized that one of the ways that he might talk about the complications that he had learned from Richards and Pound and Eliot and those sort of folks and Joyce, maybe there was a way to talk in terms of concrete, literal media that would introduce people to this type of thinking. So there was a kind of intentionality built into this, what you call first level of McLuhan media thinking.
And so when he talks later in the 60s, he starts thinking of the media as big, huge social structures and the massage. Do you think that was a discovery, or he knew 10 years before that was the next level to get to when the time...
20 years before. Because if we want to name that complication that he's talking about in the late 60s, that complication is language. And language is exactly what he was trying to figure out how to talk about in the late 1940s.
Mm.
That's what his early essays on Tennyson and Joyce and Poe and Dos Passos, et cetera, in the interior landscape, that's what those essays are all about.
Yeah. Why do you spend so much time reading McLuhan and studying him? Have you gotten used to his language so it's easy for you?
I think that I chose to do this work because I could foresee that McLuhan was going to come back into broad popularity. I think that's still growing as we speak, because McLuhan addressed questions that people increasingly see as important.
Yeah.
So that's number one. Number two, what I like about McLuhan's mind is that he self-consciously used language in both writing and speech that falls through itself. There's a great pleasure in seeing the depths of McLuhan's language. And I hope that people will be led from the first level of interesting questions about the difficulties of the world into the second level, which has to do with the possibility of answers.
So I'm working through the meaning of medium. And maybe there's something in there you want to mention. But once I do that, what do I do next? Let's see. I have a long section on Baudrillard.
That's right.
It's the transition out of the medium talk.
And I know I've never read even a single line of Baudrillard. So that's something that's I can't relate to with any sort of expertise or even familiarity.
Well, when I when you read the Baudrillard I included, what did you make of it?
Mm-hmm.
Was it too hard to understand? Too strange?
No, not too hard to understand. But I think my reaction was exactly what my reaction is to the Korean guy who's fooling around with the images on television. That Baudrillard, and from what you quote from him, seems to me to be talking about only a incidental piece of what McLuhan was doing. And so it falls into the category for me of making something more complex, which isn't invaluable, but it also isn't getting at the meat.
Right, and I don't know if you could get him to see what you mean. And you may not care if he gets it.
But so, that question, the question of passing on something, it's not as if that happens, Bob.
Right.
Right? This is exactly the problem that is already apparent with Plato and was probably already apparent to guys sitting in a cave at, 100,000 years ago or something, trying to talk to some teenager. There's nothing harder than communication. As you know, you often quote McLuhan as saying that it's a miracle when there is any communication. Right? So it's not as if I were to speak to Baudrillard, it's not as if I would be able to pass on to him what I think is missing, and the same goes for him to me. He might say, well, McLuhan has got his head up his ass. He has no idea about what's going on with McLuhan, and I'll try to teach him, but the chances of my communicating with him are almost nil.
Hmm. Okay, so what do you see next in the stages here?
What page are you on? Because I know what you're talking about in general, but in order to answer your question in particular, I have to know where exactly
in the
you
30s.
Are.
I'm in the 30s. That's where Baudrillard is, it seems. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So let me just, before we get into the 30s, let me just see what I've... I just want to see what I've highlighted on the way to the 30s to see if there's anything important here. For example, on page 19, in a letter of McLuhan's from 1952, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, good. My phone just kind of lit up for some reason. I wasn't sure what had happened.
Oh, let me see if the voice is happening. Hello. Speak.
Hello. Hello.
Yeah. Still working. Hello. Still working.
Okay, good. Yeah. So he says that he's, my object is to show the community in action rather than prove anything. That's a very important statement.
Yeah.
And proving, in the sense that he's using it here, belongs to the Gutenberg galaxy. So the movement away from the Gutenberg galaxy takes place through complication, through community in a very, very broad sense. So in the interior landscape, for example, there is a community of figures. They can be called archetypes, they can be called gods, they can be called influencers, power figures, on and on. So there's a community inside as well as a community outside. And the movement beyond Gutenberg has to do with the conversation between the people in the outside community amongst themselves and the community of the inside people amongst themselves, and then the conversation between the two groups, inside and outside. So it's a very, very complicated thing. And what McLuhan is saying here is that real explanation and real proof has to do with this complication. And that you comment that he realizes this is a new kind of science fiction. He's being a scientist, but it must include the fiction part. I think that's excellent. Yeah.
What was that?
No, I'm just saying, yeah, I think that's great what you said there, but that's still on page 20 or something, and so I'm going
right
as fast as I can up to, I want to reach where you are in page 30.
Yeah, you're scanning through. Okay. What what do you think, why did McLuhan stumble on something that everybody thought was original? Was it just the language? Talking about the vortices? Nobody was talking in the 50s about that.
In the 50s, McLuhan had virtually no audience. Nobody thought he was doing anything that was special. I mean, the first time that anybody kind of appreciated McLuhan, that appreciation didn't mean that they understood him. It just meant that they saw that his work might be usable, right? So the National Association of Educational Broadcasters, they thought, well, here's a guy that can write like the devil. If you say to McLuhan, I need a 3,000-word essay, you get it the next day. It's not something that you have to keep, bugging people over 12 months or something to get it out of them. McLuhan could just turn out whatever you wanted on the spur of the moment,
right,
in either writing or speaking. So the appreciation of McLuhan began with the National Association of Educational Broadcasters, and that was in 1959 is when he began his project with them. And so appreciation did not at all mean that they understood him. If you look at the dialogue, as I've done in some detail, if you look at the dialogue between McLuhan and the association, that especially the association's what was called its research committee, I mean, it's just laughable. They had no idea what he's talking about. None. Pardon me?
Go ahead. No, you're saying
McLuhan,
and there was another point, because if you don't say that, I'll say something. He did.
Go ahead.
Ted Carpenter says that they had, Barth and Derrida were subscribing to explorations. They thought they got an audience there. Now, they may be not listening to McLuhan, but they were reading the Explorations Journal. Some people were. What can you say about that and the reception of that journal?
Well, even in the person of Carpenter, we know that McLuhan was trying to communicate with him in such a way that Carpenter converted to Catholicism.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, Carpenter didn't get it. Right? Now, I'm not saying that getting it is right or wrong.
Right.
I'm just saying that what McLuhan was trying to talk to Carpenter about, ultimately Carpenter didn't get. He didn't get it in the only real sense of getting something, and that is to take action on it, to change your life on the basis of it, something like that. So this idea of trying to transmit something successfully is one that's very, very difficult. So if we apply that to Derrida, let's say, I think Derrida was influenced by explorations. I think he was influenced by McLuhan in ways that he did not recognize and that he played down. In the little bit he did recognize, he played down or even denied. So most people think that if you have a journal and if you write stuff in it and if it's read by somebody very famous or influential like Derrida, and if they use a little bit of what you said in the journal, then that's communication. That's great, right? But in my sense, that's not really achieving what needs to be achieved.
Yes.
And certainly McLuhan felt that way. He was relieved when they sort of got rid of the journal, even though Carpenter was doing most of the work.
Yeah.
So differentiate. Let's always keep in mind that there's education and there's education. There's appreciation and there's appreciation. For the great thing about McLuhan, to go back to the question you asked me a few minutes ago, for me, the great thing about McLuhan is that he kept in mind the big goal. And what was the big goal? Survival.
Survival.
Human survival. Right. So in comparison with that need, that demand, that vocation, everything else becomes quite trivial.
Right.
And that's where...
How could you support your idea that Carpenter didn't get it?
Because he didn't convert.
Because
at the end of the day, he didn't understand in an existential way what McLuhan was trying to say to him. Now, the reverse could also have been true. I'm not saying that McLuhan was correct. I'm only talking about whether or not communication took place.
Yeah.
And to my way of thinking, it manifestly did not.
But Carpenter has to get something about Catholicism.
Well, it's not something about. If McLuhan's interaction with Carpenter had been successful in McLuhan's sense, Carpenter would have become a Catholic. But he did not.
Mm.
And what we see in that is that there, looked at both ways, communication ultimately failed. But that's the history of Western civilization. That's the history of all civilization, I guess, but writ large in Western civilization. That even though the most important things were clear very early on, with Plato at the latest, the most important things were clear, but the education about them always has failed. And here we are in the cul-de-sac as a result of that.
So I guess I'll just ask you, what do you think I'm trying to communicate here as you go scan up, getting up into the 30s? I want to show that McLuhan was a little more complex than the cliche notions he was identified with.
Right.
So,
right. So there's, as we've often said, there's a parallel between what you're doing with McLuhan and what you're doing with Trump. what you're doing with McLuhan is you're saying that McLuhan has been mistaken by nearly everybody, including the big guns in the McLuhan industry. And the way to see that he has been mistaken is to complicate how we read him, complicate how we take him. And so that's what you're doing here in terms of the medium, right?
Okay.
Now, if I were to comment, for example, I'm on page 24 here.
Okay.
I'm looking at the third stage of the new industries were necessary to keep, for example, the automobile in service. What's wrong? There's nothing wrong with what you're saying there, but it has nothing to do with the early 70s.
Right.
Right. He was clear in the 50s that that media involve an environment, that all media are plural, that there's no such thing as a single medium. Every medium implies media. So he was very, very clear about that in the 1950s. So it's not the case that this definition occurred to McLuhan in the 70s, but it is the case that it's one of the meanings of a medium for sure.
So what is it that you would question about my book here? Where do you have a problem? Maybe you don't have a problem.
Reading doesn't involve approval and disapproval. When you take your energy to read something and your time, then you continue to do it only when you get something out of it. And what's interesting about the book, from my perspective, is that especially the McLuhan snippets, the passages that are taken from McLuhan, but also the way you relate them is interesting.
Right. So I'm trying to get you to point out something about that or comment.
Well, that's what I'm always talking about, Bob. For example, in your tiny note chart, the dynamic of the thing is what it's all about.
Yeah.
The pieces of the chart are not like jigsaw pieces that need to be seen in some kind of arrangement. They're more like, they're more like subatomic particles that are in dynamic motion relative to each other. And the question posed by the tiny note chart is, how are we to understand something like this now that we know that this is what the external and interior landscapes are like? So it's a very, very good question, and it's the question itself needs to be borne in mind. It's sort of the most important thing at this stage, because the question of going beyond, or the meta question of going beyond the questions to some kind of answer, that's the huge question that is posed to us by the whole tradition. We don't know what that is. That's why we're in the cul-de-sac.
But there's a little bit more risk today. What makes you feel that there's a little more anarchy at the top?
Yeah, well, we've already said that I would complicate what that phrase means. But there's two things going on that are difficult to deal with. One is that we have all these nuclear weapons in more and more countries. And the more nuclear weapons we have in the more countries, and the more complex arrangements there are for when they're going to be used or not used, or when they're taken out of service, when they're putting into service, and when they have to be updated in various ways and maintained. All of these complications are very dangerous, number one. Number two, there seems to be an increasing consciousness of the fact that we're in this cul-de-sac. And as you well know, that generates panic.
Yeah.
And when people are panicked, you have no idea what the hell they're going to do. So we have those two great dangers.
Yeah, I remember Baudrillard saying years ago, people know too much. They have too much information. So here we are, vulnerable humans, clumsing along clumsily, and we overlaid this instantaneous communication that can make instant panic, paranoia, and you don't know what quarters it will manifest in. The simultaneity of the electric world, that's why McLuhan would say, well, it's going to lead to more and more anarchy at the top. We need to take a break from this. Now, we won't be able to take a break from it, it seems.
Right. Of course not.
Right.
So if Amazing Polly says that she's going to become a hermit, then the planet is blown up around her, then she's not going to be a hermit anymore. She's not going to be anything anymore.
Yeah. So McLuhan was saying, to the degree it was a warning, I wonder if you could figure out the service of it. This instantaneity, that makes people panic more. Is there a way to get out of that panic without turning off the simultaneity, the cloned ESP, I call it?
Yeah, but you can't. The simultaneity can never be turned off. That's what being is.
Yeah,
that's the human environment, not in the physical sense, but in the metaphysical sense. The unanswer to your question is that we're in the cul-de-sac, and the only way to get out of the cul-de-sac is for that question to be answered.
And what is that question?
The question that that you just asked.
Okay.
And, if I cast my mind back, I don't know that I can remember the question you just asked.
About the simultaneity that intensifies the anarchy at the top.
Yeah, and so that's right. And then talking about ESP and your question was is there an answer to that, or can we get out of that? And I simply say the cul-de-sac means that we have no idea of an answer to that.
Yeah.
From McLuhan's point of view, being a Catholic means believing that the huge danger of nuclear annihilation, even if it happens, is not a contradiction of ultimate balance.
Not a contradiction of ultimate what?
Balance.
Balance.
Yeah, because, and the reason for that is that for a Catholic, and presumably this is also true of Orthodox Christianity, and maybe for the first Protestant denominations like Lutheranism and Anglicanism, the death of God is a step beyond the annihilation of the planet or the annihilation of the universe. And since the death of God turned out to be the very sign of God, then the annihilation of the planet and the annihilation of the universe is a relatively small affair. Right? So,
yeah.
But for people that aren't Catholic or Orthodox or something, or aren't, you know, Hindus, who presumably think that the universe has been annihilated many, many times, if for modern non-religious people, the annihilation of the planet, let alone the annihilation of the universe, is a pretty big deal. Right? It's sort of the end of all things, you could say.
Yeah.
The treatment of these themes is, you could say, it's what human beings are called to do, what human beings have to do, but it's also the thing that human beings least like to do. Nobody does it.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going past the Baudrillard, and I'm saying that Baudrillard, as we leave him, he started to notice the later meaning of medium, that we couldn't tell the medium from the message. He got to that point that McLuhan seemed to have gotten to, but you'll go back to 1959 and say he had the same question there.
Right. Right. We discussed that before.
Yeah.
And notice, for example, I'm on page 29, looking at what may be the first quotation you have from Baudrillard, and that is where he mentions the distinction between poles can no longer be maintained.
Yeah.
And in a certain sense, that's true, but that's the characteristic vision of the Gutenberg galaxy, right?
Yeah.
The idea that given a long enough perspective, everything comes to a point. So the big question with somebody like Baudrillard is, how conscious are they that that complications that you can identify in McLuhan, how conscious are they that some or all of these go back into Gutenberg instead of trying to think with McLuhan?
Do you see anybody thinking with McLuhan?
Well, I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
I'm trying to do that. And I see some of the work that you do as another kind of thinking about McLuhan that's very different from mine.
Yeah,
I see you as somebody who is kind of a native channeler of McLuhan. That I'm not quite sure how you did it, but you. I think already probably in the 1970s, you learned how to take McLuhan in a very complex way.
Yeah.
That's very unusual. And for me, who tries to think about McLuhan in a different way, oftentimes I find stuff in your reading of McLuhan that I didn't see before and that I like.
Yeah. Okay, so is there nobody else that you might value in the McLuhan world? Nobody.
Well, I wouldn't put it quite like that. For example, Rich Altman in Winnipeg has a mind that's a little bit like yours.
Yeah.
He thinks in what might be called a kind of natural hip-hop. And again, with Rich, I find stuff that is very different from my way of thinking about anything, but it's often interesting and very often funny. The same with Jim Pattison. Some of his artwork is very thought-provoking, and you know, I don't think that way, but I find it interesting.
Okay, that brings up George Sanderson. How do you think he understood, or did he, or was he close, or did he know?
George again. George,
you weren't you weren't talking this way back then, when you in the late 90s, were you?
Well, I certainly wasn't as familiar with McLuhan back then, so I might have talked in a somewhat similar way about other people, Hegel, Eliot, Heidegger, people like that. I might have had similar things to say, but it's true that I didn't understand McLuhan as well as I should have.
Right.
But that said, let me go on to George for a second. Because
yeah.
George is an interesting guy.
Yeah.
George again is somebody that thinks about McLuhan differently from me.
Yeah.
But George had a kind of sixth sense about McLuhan. He was able to smell stuff in McLuhan that he could see sort of in the future. And for me, it was interesting to speak with George because things that either I couldn't see or that I thought were questionable or something, George could just identify as sort of sitting right there. And so that was interesting, right?
Mm.
All these different ways of understanding somebody like McLuhan as different ways of juggling him, you could say, are interesting. Where McLuhan becomes uninteresting, and this is largely true of the industry, is where people think they can take some aspect and make it into ground, right? So
yes.
Richard Cavell, or however he says his name,
yeah.
He uses art like that.
Yes.
But, you know, that can't be done. That can't be done. Derek, he takes the internet to be some sort of fact, some sort of electronic cloud, you could say. And this is this could be used as ground, but it can't be. And then we could go through, you know, all of the different takes on McLuhan that are often very self-interested.
Yeah.
Right, so most of the people I like, right, so you and Altman and Jim George, these are all people for whom McLuhan was not a sort of an economic asset.
Right. They weren't in the academic game. They weren't trying to get something, make a career out of it.
Correct.
So the MEA, they just had their convention, and I attended it last year virtually, and it was pretty crummy watching these young people try to impress people with their paper.
What convention was this?
The Media Ecology Convention was online last year because of COVID.
Uh-huh.
And it was online this year, but I didn't want to put myself through it again.
So
I remember Zingroni telling me that he would not go to conferences. He hated people giving papers and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can relate.
Beg pardon? You can relate.
Okay, I can relate.
Yeah. So the anarchists at the top, they're going to bring in academics to advise them because they know instinctively the academics aren't going to get into any reality, and therefore they won't threaten the anarchists or the unconscious anarchists. You think that's a factor?
Well, I mean, we talked earlier about the Byzantinian bureaucracy. These people need to earn a living, whether it's in academia or in business or in government. They have to get a job. They have to do stuff. So that's not to condemn them or something. I mean, that's just the way it is. You have to eat. You have to have a roof over your head. So the problem we've got is that we've built ourselves using these avenues of commerce, these avenues of getting through life, to build a cul-de-sac, which is very, very dangerous. And we don't know how to get out of it. So these people that we're talking about, presenting their papers and one thing and another, they're part of the infrastructure of the cul-de-sac.
Right.
Nothing else.
So we've got a drought coming in over there in your area, right?
Yes.
Food problems.
Maybe, yeah. Could be the world is headed to a number of great problems which it is ill-prepared to meet simply because thinking has been in increasing abeyance for a very long time.
Yeah, so you're seeing those images of the thousands of protesters in Europe.
Yes.
The guy on my site features a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And would you say there's not as much protesting going on in America?
Seems like.
Yes.
Seems like. But the potential, I would say that the potential for something to be sparked is probably greater in America than elsewhere.
Now, why is that?
Why? Well, I mean, there's a lot of guns in America, for one thing. But there's also a tradition. Some of the early American flags had a snake on them. And either explicitly or implicitly, the message was, don't tread on me.
Yeah.
And this is something that is very deep in the American culture, but it's Americans are also sort of slow to get going because, I mean, most life in the United States is fairly comfortable. So what happens when life gets less comfortable that could happen through many, many different things. What happens then is anybody's guess. It's could be something very difficult.
Do you have a gun in your home?
No.
You're not going to get one?
No.
Now, why is that? Why wouldn't you have a gun?
I guess there's many answers to that, but I'm a non-hunting Canadian.
Okay, so can you apply McLuhan's sensory analysis to the differences between European protest and American protest, assuming that the anarchy is going to become more and more apparent to people, and people are going to get, you could say, desperate, or they're going to get creative, just operate without government among themselves, their communities. What would be the social, sensory dynamics and biases of, say, Europeans versus Americans that you and I, if we, would it be relevant? Would it be relevant to bring up?
Now, these kinds of questions, I think, are kind of silly.
So that part of McLuhan you wouldn't apply?
Well, no, I think we've already talked about that in the past, and I even sent you a quotation from McLuhan that downplayed that.
Yeah.
You're talking about the idea of being able to apply to large populations the sort of surface level of McLuhan analysis. So
yeah.
If you, turn off radio in Venezuela, it's going to have some effect. And even McLuhan said in the quotation I sent you that makes no sense, that basically he was trying to get people to think about something like that. If we want to think about how sensory levels might apply to protests in Europe and the United States, what we have to think about is the fact that the interior landscape is no less complicated than the exterior one. So if we really got research going on sensory levels, that would be like going from chemistry in 1850 to organic chemistry in 1870 to the beginning of genetics in 1900. It would involve getting very much more complex about how sensory levels work and how they work together. And then it would turn out that, of course, we can go and we can sample sensory levels in Europe, let's say, as compared to the United States, but that would be a little bit like comparing some protein in Europe as compared to America.
Mm-hmm.
And how that would be done and what the results of it would be, I think, are very, very different from how people tend to think about comparing European protest to American protest.
Could we have been made, or the core nature of humans has come forth, and the cultural differences on the surfaces have been erased the past 10, 15 years by the commonality of the digital world, Android meme. So everybody has come to a new kind of unity or ignoring of their cultural past, even though some part of the Android meme tries to fragment and get everybody to notice their differences. But do you think there's a commonality that people are starting to see in the human condition,
sure,
in this cul-de-sac?
Well, I mean, commonality can be interpreted in many, many different ways. So I thought you were headed in the direction of saying that commonality can be like a blanket that dampens down national traditions, and a great deal can be lost through that, which is true. But then you seem to get into commonality as something that is potentially valuable, which is also true, even if things are lost. So do we have more commonality in both senses? Yes, we do. How does it work within the cul-de-sac? And the answer is that it doesn't, so far, it hasn't extricated us or shown a way in which we could be extricated.
Yeah, so you have the extension of our tactility with the smartphone or these cell phones, and large parts of the world are using them. Are they massaged? Is their human nature changed? And whatever the effect of smartphones is has implemented, just like literacy did something. Granted, literacy takes a couple hundred years, but maybe the speed of the cell phone means nothing is done, but everybody's in that nothing zone, and that's the new unity here. There's a very interesting acultural phenomenon going on. People, right. they visit other cultures and tourism and that, and
Thereby destroy what they think is interesting to look at.
Yeah, and but the medium is, what would you call this, extension of the corpus callosum? No, I'm not going to go into the tech body. That's more complicated. It's not extending anything. It's just taking on a life of its own. But we go back a phase, the Android memes say, where people are acultural, seeing, and they have, today's culture is you've got to deal with a new story every day, a new surprise. It might be in your country, but there are other surprises from other countries. So the constant turmoil of the dangling ganglia, we could say we're all just dangling ganglia, and more and more people are living with that. Could that be harnessed? Could that be communicated about that we've become, you know, they probably in academia like to say we've become post-human, but that wouldn't be appropriate. So maybe para-human.
Why not? Why not? Post-human, para-human, I don't find those.
Well, because people don't believe mistaken. They're post-human. And so I think Don Thiel's term para is better, para-human. You're keeping the human in there a little bit. And then that's what my chart's about, the anthropomorphic physical. So what we project. But there is an amazing unity. And McLuhan actually talked about that, but he said it was false, you know.
Yeah.
Simulation of the body of Christ.
Yeah. It's pseudomorphic.
What does that mean?
Pseudomorphic, it's a bad imitation.
Oh, okay. Now, but it is there that everybody is massaged on that level. They are in the same boat.
Yeah. I think all of this is true, but it's just a, we're, the boat is in the cul-de-sac.
Okay. You think, the cul-de-sac just has to be recognized.
Well, you say just. I mean, I think it's it's unknown. It's like a black hole. It's unknown what goes in and what comes out.
Right.
I think most people are panicked by the very idea of the cul-de-sac. It's a very, very difficult problem to attempt to internalize.
So I see a collision, a disaster. It's not going to be stopped. I feel, for some reason, pretty confident in surviving it, coming out of it, what is it, smelling of roses. But I ain't telling my neighbor that. How do you feel about this disaster that's coming? And it's probably started about 2 weeks ago. Biden is collapsing in the polls. Okay, the polls are the poltergeist. They're everything. And if he goes down, then the journalists won't be able to be their idiocy anymore. And when they
the polls can be are fixed. Number one,
what
and the polls can be fixed.
Yes,
and they already are fixed. So maybe they just need to be tweaked to get going in the other direction. Number two, I don't think that the anybody really cares about the polls. Number three, the journalists are going to do, you know, what new journalists do. They just wait to be told what to say, and then they say it.
And a lot of people know that and don't pay attention.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure. And increasing numbers of people, for sure. But I don't think that, you know, I don't think that means anything. I don't think that's really very different from the conditions that have obtained for, at the very least, decades.
Right. The miracle is that nothing huge has happened
so far. Well, it all depends on what we mean by nothing huge has happened. I mean, if it turns out that we've destroyed great chunks of the planet in some way, either by farming where we weren't supposed to farm, or by taking water out of deep levels, or by polluting vast amounts of the ocean, on and on and on. If we've done things that we later find out in the future can't be undone, and that end up killing everybody, or killing most people, or a lot of people, or something like that, then that changes our idea of what has happened, right? We don't know, as Tom Easterbrook would say, we never know about the events of the future. That's the sort of thing he would always say to McLuhan when McLuhan was trying to talk about what could be predicted on the basis of media.
Right. Where's so that on the record?
In a talk that Easterbrook gave in 1960 with McLuhan, the two of them gave papers at the History of Economics Association. So
Easterbrook invited McLuhan to it?
No, they were both invited by a guy by the name of Cole, who was at Harvard and had been a good friend of Harold Innes. And so as a session within the meeting, the annual meeting of the History of Economics Association, he set up a session basically on Innes. And Easterbrook gave a talk on it wasn't so much on Innes, but on the promise of communication as a potential ground or as a non-variable factor in economics. In other words, would it be possible, following Innes, to take communication as something through which the history of economics could be formulated in a new way, and in a way that would not only be novel at the moment, but that would give rise to increasing research in the future? And so Easterbrook addressed that question in terms of his relationship with Innes and his relationship with McLuhan. And in the course of that, he said that his research in economics was based on uncertainty, and that he differed from both Innes and McLuhan in that. They both thought that it was possible to actually use bias as a tool of intelligibility.
So how did you find that article or those?
Oh, you have that article, Bob. I'm sure you do.
I never heard of it.
No, I'm sure that's not the case. Let me...
By Easterbrook? I have no articles by Easterbrook.
Oh, by Easterbrook. I thought you were talking about the one by McLuhan. What I can do is I can tell you the name of the one by McLuhan here. Just wait a sec. The one of McLuhan is called Effects of the Improvements of of Communication Media.
I know that.
Which was, yeah. So, and then Easterbrook, just before McLuhan spoke, Easterbrook talked on the problems of relationship of communication and economic history.
So how did you find that? You just happened to look where the conference McLuhan was at and found out Easterbrook was there?
No, I don't know how I originally knew that, but I've known for a very long time that both Easterbrook and McLuhan spoke at that conference.
Is that the only time?
But I'm more interested in people like Easterbrook than you are, Bob.
No, I didn't know you could. Well, yeah, I'm not that interested in, but if he's commenting on McLuhan, I'm interested in that, especially him.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll send you that article. It's not a problem.
Right. And he's saying that he's counting on the great unknowing. And isn't McLuhan talking about the unknowing? The invisible.
Well, that's right. I'm writing a post about that right now.
Uh-huh.
And what I'm saying in the post is that both Innes and McLuhan did not discount uncertainty in terms of the future. It's just that they were. Easterbrook takes uncertainty to be in some way disabling intelligent. What? What did you say?
I yawned. I said yes.
Oh, I see. He's, okay.
But disabling is the right word. He was disabled by it. As McLuhan would say, the modern experts don't even pretend to know what's going on. He pretended to know what was going on. He could keep talking within the uncertainty. Easterbrook couldn't.
Well, but what I say is that Innes never made up his mind between the uncertainty which gets precipitated by the multiplicity of bias or whether the multiplicity of bias was something that enabled intelligibility. So I say that Innes had both those ideas, never made up his mind about them, and probably at the end of his life tended more to the disabling of intelligibility. Well, Easterbrook was a great friend of Innes and was more or less his secretary by the end of Innes's life, and I believe that Easterbrook took over that uncertainty side of Innes, whereas McLuhan took the intelligibility side, where bias is not disabling but enables intelligibility. So that's what I'm trying to write about now.
Right.
And I should say that in regards to the uncertainty of the future, Innes, when he's thinking about the possibility of intelligibility, doesn't discount uncertainty. And same with McLuhan. It's like if you have a physicist, let's say, and you say to the physicist, well, you've got your PhD in physics. What's going to happen in this horse race tomorrow? And the physicist might well say, well, you know, I do not know who's going to win that race, but I can tell you after the race has been run, I can tell you exactly the physics of the different horses and why they came in the position they did, right? So that the uncertainty and explanation don't disable each other. They work together in a certain sense, right? If in physics, if you find something wrong with an equation about radiation, let's say, that's a great finding. People then go in and they say, well, what's wrong with the equation? And how did you measure these things? And what would that imply about other equations? So finding something wrong or uncertain is the way science works. It's the motor of science, you could say. So it's not that McLuhan discounted what Easterbrook had to say about uncertainty. It's just that he took a completely different take on what that uncertainty implied.
They didn't know how to solve the problem of pairs, is what I'm thinking of. So did Easterbrook engage McLuhan anywhere else, or was that the only time?
Well, they had been doing that for more than 30 years by 1960, right? I don't know that they had ever given papers.
Yes, I mean, I'm talking about the paper.
Like that. Yeah, so I don't know about that, but you know the little book, Speaking of Winnipeg?
Yeah.
So they have a dialogue there, and there's, you know, descriptions of them back in Winnipeg when they're, in their early 20s, apparently, walking and talking all night. So as I say in the post, outside of McLuhan's family, there's probably nobody in the world that knew McLuhan as well as Easterbrook.
Yeah. Have you looked into McLuhan's girlfriends?
A little bit, but I don't know anything about it. I just have, there's hints here and there.
It's hard to find anything.
Yeah. Very hard.
His, wasn't the female at Cambridge, was her PhD guide, his PhD guide? Who was that?
Yeah, Muriel Bradbrook. Yeah,
right.
I sent you a post I did on that. But to me, there are just suggestions that there may have been something between them. But I don't know that there was. And, she could have been a lesbian, for all I know.
Yeah.
She never got married. And she lived in a female environment all her life.
Mm.
So I really know nothing about that. And then McLuhan had a girlfriend in Winnipeg who then came over to visit him in Cambridge.
Yeah.
I forget her name, but I don't really know too much about that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, there's a woman was in the same class as McLuhan at University of Manitoba, and was also an English major, and was also in an unofficial seminar with McLuhan in Winnipeg on Monday nights, by the way. And she talks about another woman that McLuhan was sort of, I don't know, in love with or in like with or would have liked to have pursued. I don't know what the story is there. But let's just say that, like everybody else, when McLuhan came of age, he must have had many different kinds of relations with many different kinds of women.
Mm-hmm.
About which we know almost nothing.
Right. Well, okay, so I'm trying to figure out where to enter the book. Where are we?
We're at the end of your history of media.
Yeah.
In terms of McLuhan, which I don't think is correct because it's linear, and I think most of the things that you identify as stages were actually not linear, that he knew about most of those things early on. But that's not a huge matter. And then you go on to Baudrillard. And in Baudrillard, what we could do is, as far as I'm concerned, is we could comment on the quotations that you have from him, because you wouldn't have them if they weren't interesting.
Right.
And probably they can be interrogated in two different ways, each one of them. And one way is to say, what light does this throw on McLuhan? And the other way is to say, what light does it miss in McLuhan?
Yeah, because there are a lot of feminists who get into media studies, and they really dismiss McLuhan. They think he's very patriarchal, and they don't find anything useful in what he's doing. What do you think?
Sure not.
What do you think they miss?
Well, the big thing they miss is that there have been people in the history of the tradition that are about 1,000 times smarter than you are. And the whole point of education is not to learn how to dismiss concern with these people, but to figure out what they're saying.
Well, not much of that going on, is there?
No, almost none.
So
as far as I know, I'm certainly no big expert on what's happening in the humanities and the universities.
Yeah, so I take McLuhan's abstractions in a way. So I'll look at a very broad way to look at speech became obsolete. So as McLuhan says, the men went into surveillance and the women took over the old institutions. It's some quote about 1970. Have you ever heard that one?
Mm-hmm. No, I haven't, but I've heard stuff like it, and I think it's essentially true.
Right.
Turns out women are smarter than men, more capable than men, and what that means in a situation in the cul-de-sac with atomic weapons, that's a different kind of question.
Yeah, it's... If we're post, women are smarter humans than men.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
not smarter post-human, maybe.
I don't know about that.
I've been researching it. I don't think women, at least when there were women, I can't say there's women now, when there were women, they weren't too attracted by Manipian satire. It's a male thing.
Hard to say, because I can imagine that there were women that were tremendously attracted to it and were excellent performers of it, but they weren't being published.
Right.
In a patriarchal world. They were... I don't know if they were well off than at gatherings to drink tea or something. Maybe they were tremendously clever in Manipian satire, or if they were maids cleaning pots in a kitchen, there too they could have been tremendously clever. But we don't know anything about those people.
Yeah,
we know only hints about those people.
So if the tech body has no gender, that's what we're up against.
What do you mean by that's what we're up against?
Something that has no gender. It's not concerned about that. Well, it's another way of saying it's post-human. It's not human, the tech body. I noticed, there are exceptions, but... I think women found McLuhan cold, just as they found Zappa cold. Though there were lots of women in the audience, supposedly. So,
right.
But
the terms "man" and "woman" aren't very
right
enlightening, right? Many different kinds of men, many different kinds of women.
Now there's okay. So you've got these kids. I saw this article. A woman wrote to an Ann Landers kind of columnist, said she had a real problem with her teenage daughter. who switches her pronoun or whatever her category every other week.
Yeah.
That's a pretty interesting phenomenon, which I would say is quadrophenia. These kids, they got no ground, and so, but they're constantly trying to establish an identity for it. There's an extreme problem where young people are distracted.
That's the cul-de-sac for you.
Yeah.
Unconscious. But, Bob, I think we should be bringing this conversation to an end because we're almost at 8 o'clock my time.
Oh, yeah.
You got a half hour later than usual.
Yeah, well, we started
let me
late.
Say, what, yeah, for sure. But let's
go to Beaujard next.
Well, yeah, but even we'll do Beaujard next, but let's start with the question of quadrophenia and whether this is a kind of teenage problem that manifests itself in lack of focus or claimed focus. Or whether quadrophenia is also something potentially very valuable and indicates something about how new thinking has to function.
Okay.
So let's take up that range next time.
Yeah, I'll make a note to myself about that. Now I'm going to end the recording, and then I want to mention something to you. So don't hang up. Okay.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, thank you very much. That was more of a slow, to me, deliberative kind of performance.
Yeah.
Your questions were very good. You did ask me one question.
Well, you were a little tired today, Bob, I think.
No, I was introspective. Or
okay.
Yeah. Wait, trying to figure out how to talk about this without reading every line.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, I never get tired.
I never get tired.
Good.
So let's put that on the record.
All right.
All right. Here we go. I'm going to end the session. Thank you very much. That was good.
Same here.